This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. In our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier lives, we need to see the big picture of healthcare and social services and how we can make them better. The biggest advocate for boomers and seniors is AARP. With 39 million members, AARP is second only to the Catholic Church in membership size in the U.S. The U.S. Army, Navy, and Marines have 1.5 million soldiers and 1.5 million reservists, but the AARP Army of Active Volunteers has 4 million, an army whose assignments include volunteering to help more than 2 million seniors fill out those ever-complicated income tax forms. AARP's army of 4.5 million members that Mr. Rother will be talking about are busy sending emails, and AARP the magazine is the largest circulation magazine in the world. There used to be a commercial when E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen. Well, E.F. Hutton is no more, but today we might say when AARP speaks, Washington listens. And AARP's chief spokesperson is our guest today, their Director of Legislation and Public Policy, John Rother. Mr. Rother, delighted to have you with us.
It's good to be with you, Mike.
With the new president and new Congress coming in January, I'm sure you've been very busy reanalyzing what you can accomplish in Washington. What do you see as AARP's single biggest legislative goal for 2009?
Well, I think the first priority for almost everyone is to do what we can to get the economy back in shape, because unless we do that, it's going to be very difficult to do anything else. But beyond that, our biggest priority is healthcare reform. Healthcare costs too much. We don't get good value for the money we pay. The system is fragmented and too difficult for individuals to navigate very well. There are many, many opportunities for us to do better. So we think that at least getting a big start on health reform in 2009 is the job that has to be done. If we don't do that, then the current system just gets more and more expensive, and it's a threat to our national economy, but also to our family budgets.
So how are you going to go about reforming health care?
We're going full blast already on health care reform. We're working with leadership in the Senate and the House. We're trying to make sure that all of our members understand the need for reform. And we're doing a lot of research about what works best. There are lots of good examples of ideas across the country and in other countries that we think would improve the value and performance of our healthcare system.
So with that research, have you reached some conclusions about what AARP believes works best?
There are quite a few, but I'll give you a couple of examples. About three-quarters of the dollars that we now spend in Medicare are for people with chronic health conditions, arthritis or depression or diabetes, things like that that need to be managed with usually several different health providers and cooperation of family, changes in lifestyle, as well as medicine. And our healthcare system is not set up to help people manage their own condition at all. And a proposal to better align the healthcare system with this need is called the medical home. And the idea is that there should be one medical professional who has all the information, who knows you, who can help coordinate your care and answer all your questions. And that person should be rewarded for doing the right thing if that can keep you out of the hospital and help you stay healthy. So we've seen examples of that working in systems around the country and also in other countries, and we think that that's a very important tool for Medicare to incorporate.
Now, by medical home, are you talking about a doctor or are you talking about a case manager?
For most people, it would be a doctor. But it also, you know, it could be a nurse or it could be a clinic. It would be up to the patient to choose where they felt most comfortable.
How are you going to get away from the five-minute medicine where a senior, say 70 years old, with very complicated medical problems, ends up seeing the physician for 5 or 10 minutes?
Well, that's how our current system is set up, and it's not working very well. There's lots of studies that show, on average, doctors listen for about 3 seconds before they start giving prescriptions and giving advice. So I don't think that's likely to produce the kind of care we'd like to see. So One key to this is using people like nurses and social workers to help gather information and counsel patients, you know, working with the doctor. And another key to it is using the health information technology so that people can fill out questionnaires in advance and have a more complete record, both going into the doctor visit and also to help them understand what the doctor's recommendations are following.
But the key to that is going to be getting funding for that kind of support to the physicians.
Exactly. There's relatively few doctors who've adopted this kind of health information technology system on their own because it is expensive. Even though it does save money over time, the upfront investment is expensive.
One interesting example of doing that right, I interviewed John Erickson, and he got so frustrated with the system that he hired doctors to spend an hour or more with a patient to pull all the records in and have electronic records for all the patients, and got very good results from that. Is AARP looking at something that radical?
Exactly. I think that's a terrific example of the kind of innovation and out-of-the-box thinking that, frankly, we need now in our health system, because we're not going to get improvements if we just make small changes. We've got to really think about reorienting the system around the patient, making the patient the center of the care experience, not the doctor, not the hospital.
And part of the problem I have with our healthcare system, and I think the prescription medication bill aggravated it, is that we look to pills to solve everything, and we've got lots of research that says if we get people exercising more, if we get better nutrition, we'll get far better results and we won't need nearly as much medication and nearly as much health care. How does AARP see turning that around and putting as much emphasis on, say, exercise and nutrition as we place on pills?
Well, I think if you look at any of our publications, you'll certainly see an emphasis on healthy lifestyles, physical exercise, good diet, mental engagement, social engagement. All of these are very strong predictors of good health. But when I talk about health reform, we're usually talking about the insurance and the medical system.
Mm-hmm.
And these things that we're just now talking about really go well beyond that. They go to how we design our communities and how schools are run and the kinds of food that is available to us. We have a lot of work to do beyond just the insurance and medical systems to keep people in optimum health. Now, one thing I think is important to understand is that people who do take care of themselves and have healthy habits, they do have longer lives and they do have better quality of life, but they still need health services at some point, and it just may be that they need it, you know, later in life.
Mm-hmm.
So it may not be that that actually saves that much, but it pushes the expense and it pushes the illness off to later in life than would otherwise be the case.
Well, actually, we see what we call compressed morbidity, that people have less disability as they get older, and that oftentimes that expense is just in the last 6 months of life or so. We see a lot of centenarians that are pretty healthy until age 95 or 100 or more. So it's not just delaying, it's oftentimes preventing. So is there a way to financially reward physicians for paying as much attention to, say, exercise and nutrition as they do to medications?
Well, I think in all honesty, that's our own individual responsibility in our family lives and in our daily lives. I don't think we can push all of that onto the doctor's shoulders. Taking care of ourselves, eating well, exercising, staying engaged with our communities, these are all things that are definitely associated with better quality of life and happiness, for that matter, so that it's hard to push all the responsibility for that onto our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just thinking that the 5 and 10 minute visits, there isn't any possibility of having a serious discussion about that. But you're suggesting that you say it is mostly the educational function and the magazines and seminars and that kind of thing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I am, because I think no matter how much time a doctor spends with you, and certainly 5 to 10 minutes is a travesty, but even if a doctor had, say, half an hour, most people are not going to be in the doctor's office unless they have some problem they're dealing with. And I think most doctors may not feel that they're the best source of information for some of this healthy lifestyle information that nutritionists and exercise therapists, other professions really focus on that.
Yeah, I think they have to hand that off to somebody who is both, frankly, more knowledgeable about it and more passionate about it. Just want to make it worth their while to do that.
These things do cost a little money, but certainly a lot less expensive than an unnecessary hospitalization.
Mm-hmm. If we look at managed care, Kaiser Permanente started off with a great idea of putting more emphasis on prevention and intensive services that prevented hospitalizations. And unfortunately, that managed care system often got perverted into just managing costs. Is managed care dying and dead, or does AARP see a role for managed care?
Well, we think that integrated health care plans do have the potential to do a better job at not only managing costs, but managing care. As you note, though, it's easier for them just to manage the cost. And managing care takes a lot of hard work and, again, thinking outside the box of the traditional healthcare delivery. There are some examples, usually the smaller systems, where we're seeing, you know, really good results, but, you know, they're the exception to the rule. But, you know, a doctor practicing alone or maybe with one other doctor in a rural area, it's awfully hard to put together the combination of services and supports that are really necessary to do this well. You do need to have some ability to organize a care system, not just one or two people, to make this real. And for that reason, I think organizations like the Mayo Clinic, for example, Geisinger Health System in Pennsylvania, really have something to share and to share with all of us about how to do a better job with existing level of resources. You know, it takes a structure to do that. It's very hard to do just with an independent practitioner.
Is there a way for consumers to easily access information about the role models you just mentioned?
Well, unless people are willing to read through some health policy journals, it's hard because I think the popular press doesn't often cover it this way. But once in a while, you'll see an article in some of the magazines that'll say healthcare is different in different parts of the country, different levels of quality, different levels of cost, and give examples of typically the places that do a better job in terms of quality also cost less.
It sounds like a natural for AARP magazine, and I have seen some articles like that. Matter of fact, just a couple months ago, there was an excellent article about why healthcare is so expensive.
Yeah, thank you. I had a role in getting that into the magazine, and I hope we'll have more articles like that to help people understand what we've learned or what we are learning about best practices in healthcare and what we as individuals can do to, you know, move our healthcare system forward.
Well, bravo for getting that article in.
Well, thank you. Again, we hope it's just the first of many.
I hope so. The Medicare prescription bill, are you going to be trying to make changes in that, or is that one of the lower priorities?
You know, here's the dilemma. Big problem with it is the donut hole.
Mm-hmm.
And like everything else in healthcare, it would be expensive to just add coverage in that donut hole, as important as it is. So while we hope that it's going to be possible to do that, we are also at the same time, you know, dealing with 47 million Americans with no health insurance at all, with all these other problems in our healthcare system. So I don't think it's going to be at the top of the list of things to fix for this administration, the incoming administration, but it is on the list. It is something that we've urged be addressed, and certainly President-elect Obama has acknowledged that it needs to be addressed. It's just, I don't think it's going to be one of the first things done. I think instead a way to address the people without any health insurance at all is probably going to take priority.
That, and this probably isn't the best year to be asking for more money until the economy gets a little stable.
Yes.
As I see it, Americans have been subsidizing the R&D cost for medications for the rest of the world. With 39 million members, AARP versus the pharmaceutical industry is a monumental battle. What are your priorities in trying to get more reasonably priced medications for Americans?
It's a little more complicated than that. I think in terms of the generic drugs that are now available, we actually have some of the best prices in the world. And the fact that you can go to a Walmart or Target or some other drugstore and get very effective generic drugs for $4 a prescription is truly unique in the United States. But in terms of the brand drugs, they seem to be getting more and more expensive. And in terms of the biologics, the newest class of drugs probably hold the most hope for the future. These can be horribly expensive. We're talking, you know, over $10,000 or $20,000 a year. So, you know, what we are doing is, first of all, trying to give Medicare more bargaining clout and negotiating prices for drugs. But secondly, we're trying to work with the drug companies because, after all, we do want them to succeed. We want them to innovate and to get new therapies to market. But, you know, the pricing is ridiculous. We've got to have some way that allows people to afford important drugs that can keep them healthy. So we're still working away at that and talking directly to the industry, but also at the same time urging Congress to take on the pharmaceuticals. As you know, though, pharmaceuticals seem to have more money than anybody, and they can mount very effective campaigns in the Congress, and they, of course, give a lot of money to congressional candidates. So it's an uphill fight at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not so naive as to think that if we cut off their money, then they don't have the R&D money to develop the wonderful drugs that they're developing. I just think it's unfair that Americans seem to be paying more for the non-generics than the rest of the world. I wish there were a way to balance that.
I agree with you. And the area that we're talking to the industry in terms of cost savings has to do with the expense of marketing. Hardly any other countries permit the kind of advertising that the drug companies do in the U.S., and that adds a lot to the cost of drug. And whether it's TV advertising or magazine advertising or the so-called detailing to individual physicians, drug companies spend about 40% of their total budget on that kind of marketing, and that adds significantly to the cost.
So are they wishing that kind of advertising would go away too, that they would have limitations so they wouldn't have to spend the money to compete against their competitors?
Well, in all the rest of the world, you know, there is no direct-to-consumer advertising for pharmaceuticals. And yet, you know, people still take drugs because they rely on their doctor's advice. And I personally think that we need to kind of get back to that more rather than having people show up at the doctor's office demanding to get a prescription for the latest thing they've seen on TV.
Is that going to take legislation?
Yes, it would take legislation, and I'm sure it would be resisted not only by the drug industry, but by the TV, radio, and publishing industries as well.
A lot of special interests there.
Exactly.
Big Pharma also is putting pressure to limit or shut down compounding pharmacies and limit supplements. Is AARP involved in fighting that?
Our main concern is that these products be safe and that people understand the pros and the cons of taking supplements and other things like that. So we want to make sure that they're run through the FDA process and that we have some assurance that they're actually going to work as advertised and that they are safe. That's our main concern.
Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to be in a nursing home. In addition to the obvious reasons for not wanting to be there, there's no privacy, the food is terrible, and frankly, theft is common. Is there anything that AARP can do to improve the quality of life? I mean, the standards say we'll serve nutritious food, etc., but nobody wants to eat that food.
No, there is, Mike. Again, we see some best practices in different places around the country that offer a real alternative. One alternative that's spread pretty widely across the country now is called assisted living. And a lot of people who would formerly qualify for a nursing home or need nursing home care are now in assisted living units, which have more home-like features, do offer individual privacy and more home-like experience. But even for people who need the more intensive care, there are new programs. I think some are called Greenhouse or some Eden Alternative. And the basic idea is the same, is to make them smaller scale, residential, have rooms that, you know, respect people's privacy, and foster a more social kind of atmosphere rather than, you know, just the passive, inert patient. And I think those are showing that you can actually provide nursing home type services in an environment that's much more life affirming and pleasant to be in than the traditional nursing home. So I personally hope that nursing homes as we've known them in the past go out of business, because no one wants to be in one, and we now know how to do it better, not more expensively. So it's just a matter of converting unsuccessful model to a one that works better.
Well, certainly writing about those in like AARP magazine is one vehicle. Does it need a legislative push as well?
Well, actually, some of this can go on under current law. It's just a matter of getting the industry to invest and to convert the existing nursing homes to this new model. You don't need law, you just need people willing to invest in leadership at the local level.
We're talking with John Rother, AARP's Director of Legislation and Public Policy, and I would point out that AARP is about the best bargain, least expensive membership organization you can belong to. It's $12.50 for 1 year, and that includes your spouse or partner, and $39.95 for 5 years. But, John, I suspect your biggest interest is in recruiting volunteers to support legislation.
Well, the fact that people are willing to roll up their sleeves and work as a grassroots, part of a grassroots effort, is absolutely critical to our success. It's the one thing that AARP has that our well-financed opponents often do not have, the ability to generate phone calls and emails and letters, and really depend on volunteers, activists across the country to reinforce the messages that we're sending into the Congress and to elevate the importance of the urgency of taking action on some of these concerns. So it's absolutely critical. We saw other people throughout the campaign season the last 2 years show up at events, sponsor debates, really get involved in a very meaningful way, and it does make a difference. So we're certainly encouraging this, and we hope to see even greater level of direct involvement by older persons. We've had a lot of attention in the last few months to greater youth involvement, primarily with the Obama campaign, and of course that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But we also think that there's real potential for greater involvement by seniors and older adults as well.
For that, I just saw some research that said that using the internet is one of the best ways to keep your mind sharp and uses more parts of the brain than even reading. So if a person wants to be up to date on what AARP is doing legislatively and send emails or contact legislators on issues, how do they get tuned in?
Well, I would urge people to be in touch with their state offices. AARP has an office in every state. That's how we're organized in terms of our grassroots work, is through our state offices. And we have people in every state who are charged with trying to build up that grassroots. And so emails do make a lot of sense, because it's fast, it's cheap, and it's very effective. So the old days we had telephone trees and, you know, relied on letters. Today it's much more electronic, and as a result, it's more efficient and, I think, more convenient for people as well.
We'll get back to John Rother in just a moment, but first, a word about speaking services. Note how old you feel now. You will soon feel a lot younger after hearing Dr. Bricky. That's how I'm usually introduced when I give a keynote address. We are brainwashed with limiting beliefs about aging. As America's preeminent anti-aging psychologist, I bring good news for a change. A change in how you view aging. And I do it with a good helping of humor. In short, I help audiences learn the mental game for living longer, healthier, and happier. But I'm not satisfied with people just acquiring information and having a feel-good time. I have people adopt healthier beliefs on the spot and lock them in for lifelong benefits. I also like to stay and do breakout sessions, consulting, and individual coaching at no additional cost. When your organization or business needs a speaker, have them check out my demo video at anti-aging-speaker.com. That's anti-aging-speaker.com. And give me a call. My phone number is on all my websites. And now back to John Rother. Getting back to assisted living, you said assisted living, this is a quote from you, assisted living is becoming so popular that everyone's changing the sign on the door no matter what they provide. What kind of limits or legislation do we need for assisted living to keep it what it should be?
Well, that's a great question, because in the early days, you're right, anyone could call themselves assisted living as long as they had some, you know, like a private room. But we've worked with the industry and with other consumer groups to develop a code, standards for assisted living, and we're urging the states to adopt those codes as a licensing standard so that anyone that's licensed by the state as an assisted living facility would need to demonstrate that it can actually provide the services. And I think that's working pretty well. Of course, we haven't gotten it through every state, but we're making real progress. So I do have some hope that the label assisted living, at least in most states now, is something that consumers can rely on. Of course, there's no substitute for going to visit and asking a lot of questions to make sure.
So a lot of people think of AARP as, oh, you get great discounts on car rentals or something, but one of the things they wouldn't think of is providing legislative models for something like assisted living.
Yes, in fact, I think a lot of what we do is, in a way, behind the scenes like that. It's urging the states and local governments to take action. It's also working directly with the industry to say, hey, you know, you've got a brand or a product that you want to protect its good name, and therefore you need to assure that people who use that name can deliver, because you don't want to have, you know, the exposés and the bad press. So, you know, people generally, I think, are responsive to that. Not everyone, but in general, we found that there's a willingness to work with us in terms of consumer protections and making sure that we can deliver what's promised when we say the word assisted living.
Wonderful. Some of the critics of our healthcare system say Medicare is so efficient at paying bills and setting standards, and the marketing that goes into our insurance companies marketing their products is so expensive that we ought to use Medicare as a single payer for everybody. What has AARP's analysis of that approach been?
It's a little more complicated than that. First of all, Medicare, many people don't realize, is actually administered by private insurers. They handle the claims processing and they cut the checks that go out to doctors and hospitals. And, you know, Medicare, you know, funds it, but we say that Medicare is very efficient. We usually don't include the cost of that private administration in the numbers, so it's not quite as good as it looks. But I think Medicare for All is certainly a viable and an important idea, but it's not the idea that President-elect Obama ran on. It's not the idea that Senator Ted Kennedy is pushing. It's not the idea that Senator Max Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, is going forward with. So while I think its theory makes a whole lot of sense, the politics really are moving us in a different direction. And the politics are that people who have employer-based insurance generally like it and want to keep it. So what we're talking about now is not converting everybody into a Medicare-like system, but rather just people who are in the individual, small group market, the uninsured, trying to build up a system for them that would look like the health benefit plan for federal employees that most members of Congress have. And that's a system based on the choice of different private plans, but it is publicly funded and regulated so that the plans are not engaging in any unfair practices and they have to adhere to, you know, consumer protection standards. So I think that's what we're going to get. It's not that people say that this Medicare for All is a terrible idea. It's just that the political possibilities don't lead that direction.
And the system you were talking about for small groups and individuals, that would be a new entity from Medicare?
Well, I think that's what's being debated right now as the Congress gets ready to introduce health reform legislation for next year. And what they are talking about is something that's actually pretty similar to what's been enacted already in Massachusetts, where you have, again, people with employer-provided insurance are pretty much left alone. But for people who are in the individual market or very small groups, they are part of a new system that's under something called the Health Connector, and through that they can have a choice of plans, private plans, and they can get much more reasonably priced insurance. Now, to make that work, though, you have to have everybody included and everybody paying in. So that's where you get to the controversy, the so-called individual mandate or individual responsibility, that we don't really have a system that can spread the cost unless everybody participates.
Sounds like the realism of politics is the systems aren't going to get any simpler anytime soon.
Absolutely. And we're a pragmatic country. We generally don't adopt programs and policies on the basis of ideology, but rather on the basis of what seems to work best. And I think most people feel that the Massachusetts experience is working. It's allowing people to get health coverage at an affordable rate, and looks to me like that's going to be the model for an effort to enact national health reform. Still a lot of questions outstanding about how to do that, but I think the Massachusetts experience is what everybody is looking to right now as an example of a kind of a pragmatic compromise.
Sounds like another great article for AARP, the magazine.
Indeed, yes.
Seniors in particular go from specialist to specialist with the 5 to 10 minute visits, and they get a lot of lab tests, and rarely is that really integrated. If we had electronic records, the physician could look at a graph of all the lab tests over the last 10 years and all the changes in medications over the last 10 years and see the patterns. I realize this isn't a good time to be asking Washington to spend more money, but how close are we to getting electronic records?
Everyone realizes that this is a necessary step. You know, we have a 19th century paper-based health system when all the other parts of the economy are computerized, and that there are many examples, as you know, where electronic records would not only provide better care but also save money, because you wouldn't have to repeat tests over and over every time you saw another doctor. The question is, how do we get there? And there are two barriers that have stopped us from going forward so far. One is the cost. Doctors will tell you that they simply can't afford to put in a whole system. It's not the cost of the equipment as much as it is the cost of converting all of their existing paper records to electronic form. That's a big job, and the question is, who's going to pay them to do that? The other reason we haven't gone forward are concerns about privacy. There are people who care quite a bit about privacy, and they have, in effect, blocked movement on this whole issue in the Congress because they aren't satisfied with the privacy protections in the legislation. So if we can get those two issues resolved, the how to pay for it and the privacy issue, then I'm pretty confident we can move aggressively to bring our healthcare system into the 21st century, as so many other parts of the economy have also recently converted to digital electronic information systems.
I think there's a third issue. Even if we solve the cost and the privacy issue, if every insurance company sets up a different system of electronic records, then every time you change insurance companies, you have to redo everything or it doesn't transfer. We've got a terrible inefficiency.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't do any good if everyone's got their own system and the systems can't talk to each other. It's widely understood that in order for us to have the potential reached that this whole electronic revolution could promise, the systems have to be able to talk to each other and share information, regardless of who your insurance is or who your doctor is or what hospital you've been to. So yeah, that does take a little additional work. But in a way, that's a technical problem, you know, and that's, relatively speaking, easily solved compared to the other two problems that I've mentioned, the how to pay for it and the privacy issue.
I would think that the more that the federal government could come up with formats and standards, it would save an awful lot of grief down the road.
We're going to see movement on this in the coming Congress, because I don't think we're going to get very far in all the other things we want to see in terms of improvements and better quality, better value, without some real effort to get health information systems in place. And so we're probably going to see some efforts to put subsidies for doctors and hospitals into the economic stimulus package that will be the first order of business next year. Because after all, it's a way to spend money, and it's a way to keep people employed, and it's a way to improve the healthcare system while we're at it. So I think there's a lot of support for it.
Wonderful. AARP's advocacy and legislative agenda puts a lot of emphasis on serving poor and disenfranchised people. I suspect that most of the membership is actually middle class or even affluent. Where did this strong commitment to the poor come from, and is there any difficult balancing act, or is the membership very supportive of it?
Well, we do have a AARP foundation that raises money from members and receives foundation grants that's dedicated to helping those who are least advantaged or most disadvantaged among the older population. So we do give special emphasis to our efforts to help the most vulnerable through our foundation. But in our regular work, we try to do things that benefit everyone. And of course, if you do benefit everyone, then the people, again, who need it the most are the ones usually at the bottom of the scale. So if it's improvements in pensions, or if it's improvements in job opportunities, or even, you know, consumer protections, if you're doing things that can help and protect the middle class, you're typically also doing things that help and protect those with lower incomes. So, we try to take a broad approach.
It sounds like a Solomon-like distinction of coming up with the foundation.
Well, it's not always possible. And, you know, but one thing I do want to point out is that it was just a generation ago where to be old meant that you were poor. And public policy was based on the fact that people 65 and over were people who were living on very limited incomes, who needed all kinds of help, and many of the programs that we have are a result of that. But today, things have changed, and it's good that things have changed. We have a large number of middle-class retirees, and even, you know, people who are wealthy who are older as well. And so we're going to see public policy change in response to that. And we've already seen examples where in Medicare, people who have more money are going to be asked to pay higher premiums. People who have higher incomes are paying special taxes on their income tax, on their Social Security benefits. It's all a way to try to stretch every dollar so that the impact on the people who are most in need is as much as it can be. But this is one of the real, I mean, you're right to call it a balancing act, because, you know, you can't go too far in that direction, or you risk turning these programs into welfare programs that will suffer from lack of political support.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely pressure from the Congress to try to charge more to upper-income retirees or to limit benefits in some way. And we often find ourselves opposing those ideas because we think it's important to maintain the universality of programs like Social Security and Medicare, just like it is to maintain the universality of public education.
Probably most boomers have no idea of that history and don't realize the paradigm shift that has taken place in terms of most seniors being poor.
Yeah, I think most people in middle age really see this issue through the eyes of their parents. And, you know, it all depends what the situation is parents have. Most people imagine that they'll be in the same situation, but of course, it's hard to predict.
Mm-hmm. When the job market constricts, seniors are probably the miner's canary. In helping seniors get jobs, which AARP has paid a lot of attention to, do you see the strongest need is advocacy, education, or legislation?
I'm not sure how much we can do legislatively to create jobs just for older persons. I think legislation and economic policies can help create jobs for everyone. Where we have focused is on two things. Number one, trying to work directly with employers to change attitudes about older employees. Because, you know, there is stereotypes and there are negative attitudes toward older persons that are still prevalent in the minds of many employers. And we've done studies and we've done economic analysis to try to show that those attitudes are not justified, that in fact older workers are often more productive and can add more value to a business than even a younger worker. But on the other hand, we do find still way too many instances of overt age discrimination. And we have a staff of lawyers in-house that work with the EEOC and work in the federal courts to try to remedy these examples and to achieve not only justice for the individual, but to really send a message to the employer community that we're not going to tolerate overt age discrimination.
And some of the studies you commission are just very high quality. I've been very impressed with them. I don't think it was one of your studies, but one of the ones that impressed me the most is with air traffic controllers. They had a mandatory retirement age of 50, and doing research with traffic controllers over 50, they found that they were at least as effective as the younger air traffic controllers because they could see the patterns more quickly. So now they're reconsidering mandatory retirement age for the air traffic controllers.
You know, it's interesting because age is a very blunt way to try to assess individual capacity. What we find is that increasingly, as people are healthier and productive much later into life, that using age as a indicator of whether somebody can or cannot do a job is really, frankly, ridiculous. So what it requires, though, is a more individualized approach to assessing people's abilities as they get older, because some people do have fall-off in ability, and others don't. And so it becomes important to do these kind of individualized determinations rather than just assuming that anyone at age 60 or 65 or whatever is no longer qualified to work.
Exactly. Baby boomers hate to grow old, and many probably see AARP as a sign that they're getting old, so they shy away from any association with it. How is AARP trying to overcome that I'm not that old syndrome?
Well, first of all, we don't use the word old. And secondly, we are trying to put forward a more positive image of what it means to grow older. We're trying to put in our, especially in our magazine, put positive images of people who are vital in contributing well into older ages, and people who are usually on our cover, there's someone who's turning 50, and they're oftentimes they're celebrities, they're entertainers, and usually it's something like 50 is the new 30 or something, because people are obviously in the prime of their lives and obviously enjoying themselves and contributing at that age. So, you know, we're trying to put forward more positive images of aging. We're trying to document it through our research, as we've just discussed. And we're trying to encourage people to stay involved. Even if you're not working, stay involved in your community as a volunteer, a person that's got something to offer, because all the research shows that people who do stay involved have a higher quality of life, they're happier, and they live longer. And you know, so it's a win-win. It's good for you as an individual, but it's certainly good for the community, certainly good for the economy. So we're doing what we can to try to put out a much more positive view of what it means to grow older. For many people in their 70s and 80s, who I work with every day, you can't tell that that's their chronological age.
Mm-hmm.
They're living the idea that you're only as old as you feel.
It hadn't dawned on me all those cameos of people age 50 was to catch the boomer attention. 2007, you started the Divided We Fail campaign and created the Elefonky icon with half elephant, half donkey. What's happening with Divided We Fail?
Well, Divided We Fail was an effort to capture public attention and capture the attention of political candidates with really a message about unity, a message that said, look, we are tired of this partisan bickering. We like to see results. We've come together with business leaders and with labor leaders to try to demand some action. I thought it was pretty successful. It was a way of getting people engaged at the grassroots level and at the leadership level. It allowed us to go kind of arm in arm with business leaders and labor leaders in to see political candidates and elected officials and say, look, you know, we agree, why can't you? It's both a way to show solidarity with each other, but also to demand action. We hope that we can keep that going. We'll see how far, but we hope we can keep it going into 2009. and continue to press Congress to act, especially on health care. That's the issue that is the most urgent, I think, from everyone's point of view. But also on retirement security issues, the issues we've been talking about, jobs, pensions, Social Security, we all feel that there's an agenda that Congress needs to take on, and that we hope that they can do a better job going forward than in the past, where so much has gotten blocked from happening just because of partisan differences.
So the public is fed up with partisanship, and AARP, along with the organizations it's working with, is trying to create a groundswell of saying, enough of the partisanship, let's work together, and you know that's what we're supporting.
Exactly. I hope that message has a future, and I think in some ways it's similar to the message that Senator Obama used for his campaign about we're not a red state or a blue state country, we're one country. And that's kind of our message as well. It's time to get past this stuff and on to solving some problems.
With AARP's clout, it helps create that groundswell, and I'm just delighted to see it. One last question. Any agenda on Social Security in the next year or two?
Social Security is something that needs to be addressed at some point, but I think it's fair to say that health care is the more urgent and more difficult problem. Social Security, we had a big fight with President Bush on over the issue of private accounts and turning Social Security into more of a private investment type program. We prevailed on that, and I think the stock market crash has put an emphatic end to that debate. So in a way, Social Security now is easier because we don't have that private account idea with any credibility left. So I think that it is going to be possible to address Social Security long-term financing, but only after we first deal with health care.
I would think one of the easiest ways to make it more financially viable would be just raising the retirement age of some of the future retirees. Is that
well,
on the agenda?
Retirement age is already going to 67. I actually think we don't need to raise it any higher. I think there's other things you can do. I'm not sure how many people are really going to work till 67. One thing that we could do is we could take another look at the earliest date of eligibility, which is 62. And certainly most people can work beyond 62, and so I think that's a more likely focus.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with John Rother, AARP's Director of Legislation and Public Policy. For information on AARP, it's just aarp.org. Remember, it's .org, not .com. John, if there were one thing that you would like people to do in terms of one piece of legislation to support or email to send, or what action would you like them to take?
I think the most important legislation next year by far is going to be health reform. And so we would like people to be in touch with their elected officials to say how important this is, how urgent it is. And as we see more details about the legislative proposals, we hope that people will support their elected officials who are willing to support reform. It's the best thing we can do, not only for ourselves, but for our kids and grandchildren.
So the immediate need, the immediate message is to our legislatures is make this a top priority.
Absolutely.
John Rother, thank you so much for sharing with us what AARP is doing. I think it's just a fabulous organization and appreciate you sharing this with us.
Well, I've enjoyed our conversation, Mike.
Commentary. Author John Irving brought us The World According to GARP, and today John Rother brings us The World According to ARP. AARP is a very complex organization. While the public tends to think of the magazine, newspaper, and senior discounts, AARP is doing a lot of things behind the scenes, such as researching best practices, developing and promoting model legislation for services like assisted living, commissioning research on job discrimination, fighting job discrimination in the courts, and organizing millions of volunteers to do things like helping seniors who are poor and overwhelmed fill out those complicated income tax forms. Today we learned that in 2009, AARP's top legislative priority is health care, which John Rother describes as too expensive, too complex, and not a good value for our money. One of the best practices that he particularly liked was the concept of a medical home. That is having one medical professional with all the information about the patient. Personally, I think that'll work a lot better if that person coordinating is usually a nurse or nurse practitioner or possibly a medical social worker as opposed to the physician because of the physician's very limited time. We mentioned the donut hole. In case you're not familiar with that, in Part D, the prescription drug program under Medicare, a senior would select a plan, in most cases make monthly premium payments, and as they purchase drugs, only have to pay a usually modest copay for the medication. But when the retail cost of that reaches $2,700, and I say retail cost because remember with prescription D, there was no provision for the government negotiating less than full retail prices with the pharmaceutical companies. So at $2,700, all of the expenses now are out of pocket, and the Medicare recipient has to continue paying their premium as well. And that continues until we get to the $4,350 level, at which time the copay system kicks back in. In other words, after that first $2,700, the senior has to pay $1,650 before they get back into the copay. Mr. Rother indicated that while he thinks this is a big problem, it probably isn't going to be a high priority in 2009 because of feasibility and the shortage of funds. If the restriction on Medicare negotiating better prices were lifted, that savings alone may cover the whole donut hole gap. Mr. Rother also indicated that Social Security reform probably won't be able to be this year's priority. With nursing homes, I was delighted to hear him talk about best practice alternatives and how he hopes that those will push our current nursing home models out of existence. A couple of things I disagree on. When it comes to supplements and compounding pharmacies, Mr. Rother suggested that AARP's emphasis is on safety, and he seemed content to let the Food and Drug Administration handle those issues. The pharmaceutical companies want you taking their medication and are rather predatory with supplements and compounding pharmacies. The problem is that the Food and Drug Administration is woefully inept and woefully overwhelmed and primarily staffed by people who are extremely friendly to the pharmaceutical business. So it's the fox guarding the hen house. Certainly, we do need to make sure that supplements and prescriptions from compounding pharmacies are safe, but I can't imagine the Food and Drug Administration doing an adequate job of policing that. A second point that I disagreed on is when we talked about exercise and nutrition, he pointed out that AARP and their magazines and publications are doing a lot in that area, which they are. But in terms of doctors, he sees that as our responsibility. I certainly don't see the doctors having either the expertise to go into great detail in those subjects or the interest or the time. But I do think that we put an enormous amount of stock in what they say. An awful lot of people have quit smoking because their doctors told them to, or started an exercise program because their doctors told them to. So I think doctors should use their enormous influence with patients in trying to get them to use better nutrition, exercise more, quit smoking, and things like that. He or she can then make a referral to a program, to an expert, hand it off to the nurse practitioner, or some other member of his or her team. One of the things I would most like to see in healthcare and in taxes is to make it simpler. The system has become so complex, it's a nightmare. You can literally hire people to handle your insurance forms and reimbursements because so many people, especially seniors, are often overwhelmed by these. We often pay accountants hundreds or even thousands of dollars to do our income taxes because it's so complex. That's money that's not generating value for our system. The more we can get healthcare and get taxes more efficient and get the middlemen out of it, the more we'll all be better off. Unfortunately, I think Mr. Rother gave us a very realistic answer when he said, when it comes to legislation, our country tends to make pragmatic adjustments rather than starting with theoretical models. So it looks like getting more simplicity is going to be a hard-fought incremental process if we get it at all. As you gather, I'm a big fan of AARP. I would note that there is a balancing act, and as they get more involved in providing services such as insurance, there will be a temptation to not take any actions that might not be good for the products and services they provide. So they are on a bit of a slippery slope, and I hope that they are very prudent and able to monitor themselves. One of the ways they seem to have done that so far is having several different divisions, for example, delegating most of their philanthropic activities to the foundation. Emails. I love getting those emails. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@agelesslifestyles.com. Last week we had Doug Splitgerber and Deborah Corbo on resistance training, and it got quite a bit of response on that. Most of it agreeing that the emphasis on posture was very appropriate and the emphasis on resistance training is good advice, but objections to how they seemed to say that everybody else was doing everything wrong. People tend to see that as a red flag. Also concerns that if it's so difficult to use weight with proper alignment and get it right, doesn't that run the risk of people trying to use the proper form but not quite understanding it and injuring themselves? And finally, there were concerns that minimizing the importance of cardiovascular training is probably throwing the baby out with the bathwater, that cardiovascular is very important. A reminder, for information on anti-aging psychology, my books and CDs, or to subscribe to my free Defy Aging newsletter, just go to my portal site, notaging.com, notaging.com, and it will link you to all my information and services. Podcasts are on webtalkradio.net and on agelesslifestyles.com. And I'd love to get your feedback and comments. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. Next week, NPR correspondent Eric Weiner will take us around the world in a quest to find the happiest countries in the world. Please join us then. And until then, this is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.